This recording of Ram Dass took place at the Learning Annex in Sacramento, California on October 22nd, 1996.
Good evening. Through the good offices of the Learning Alliance, we are here. I think it was because I just wanted to come back to Sacramento, which is interesting, and they kept inviting me. Because I remembered, I guess, the last time I was over at the theater, and I felt there was a true meeting of hearts. I think that's what draws me back. For those of you that have not met me, I am Ram Dass. And Ram Dass means servant of God. It's just a way of saying it within a Hindu tradition. So I am in the service of God. That's what my name implies. I have also taken the word Ram, which is the name of the nameless, the finger pointing at the moon, another of the names of God, the unspeakable. And I use it as an acronym, R period A period M period, standing for rent a mouth. And it strikes me, when I try to figure out what these evenings are about, is that you have rented my mouth to say to you what? What's fascinating is to say to you things you already know. And I know, because from where I'm sitting, when I say the wisest thing I can think of, you go like this. Now, if you go like this, you knew. And if you knew, what did you need to come here? This great sacrifice, what for? I mean, you already know it. So I thought, well, it obviously isn't rational that we're getting together. It's as if we have to keep saying it to ourselves over and over again. It's like a practice. It's a transformative practice, because each time we say it a little more clearly, we say it more deeply connected to one another. We say it so that it takes us into the space itself that we're talking about. It's experiential. It's like water wearing away stone. What I see our predicament is that there is an awakening in consciousness to an appreciation of the relative nature of reality. And that changes the meaning of everything. Everything. Like, when I was in high school, I learned Newtonian physics, and my teacher taught it to me as if it was absolutely true. And I learned it that way, and that was the definition of how reality was. And then Einstein came along, and he said, you know, it depends on where you're standing. He said, relative to what? And that is a profound mystical statement. Because what it shows us is that there are more than one plane of reality. There are different realities. Now, for example, let me just use an old example I always use because it really works perfectly. If you had a little channel selector right by your eyes and you set it to channel one, and you look up here, what you see is a 65-year-old, overweight, gently decaying, very attractive man. You gutter papillon. Okay? So that's one level. That's the plane, the reality. That's the physical plane you experience through your senses. Now shift it one channel. And now you look at me and you see a speaker role. You see a Caucasian. You see a 65-year-old man, but you see a senior person. It's again role, relationship. You see a neurotic. You say, boy, he must be really neurotic. I mean, what you do is, it's like the psychotherapists only see reality on this plane. They're all tuned to this channel. This is the channel of as the world turns, basically. There are bodies moving around, but basically it's heavy psychodynamic drama, and that's on channel two. It's on your social roles, social identity, all that, the whole shtick, all your psychosocial stuff. Flip to channel three. Now you look up here and you say, I bet you're an Aries. Or if you don't want my astral identity, you might say, he looks like a person in search of the truth. Hear that kind of mythic ring to it, kind of archetypal stuff? That's all there. That's on channel three. That's where Joe Campbell would hang out. Now you flip to channel four, and an interesting thing happens. Because if you look at anybody and look them in the eye, they're looking right back at you. There's another one in there just like you. Are you in there? How did you get into that one? And you suddenly begin, you become aware of another soul just like you, who happens to be packaged differently. Packaged in archetype, packaged in personality, packaged in body, culture, da 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 da. But behind the packaging, you in here, I'm here. Far out trip this incarnation, isn't it? Wow, have you gotten the hang of it yet? What do you think it's all about? You know? Who created this nutty thing? It's as if we meet as fellow journeyers along the path. You there, I'm here. How's your trip going? Oh, it's hell. Well, enjoy it. I was at the golf course a few months ago, and I always get paired because I play in midday since I'm retired. I always. I play with three retired Republicans. And so, because that's who I get paired up with. I mean, it's great. And this one guy was miserable. I mean, every shot he swore, and he threw the club, and he was furious. And he got to the second hole, and I said to him, are you enjoying yourself? Yes. I said, oh, great. Be my guest. Enjoy. See, that's a soul view of an ego trip. If you see what I'm talking about here. And of course, if you try the next channel, then you're just talking to yourself, talking to yourself, talking to yourself. There's only one of it in drag. The one becomes the many, but the many is still the one. So we are all one thing, and it's talking to itself. This is an internal process, nothing personal. And just to keep the Buddhists happy, if you turn at the next channel, the channel disappears. The hands disappear, and the whole shtick disappears. And all the religions are at play somewhere in between those last two channels. That contract is up on those channels. So what happened to me, to make a long story short, is I was galumphing along as a Western scientific materialist, as every good member of the society is. Where the shopping malls are our temples. They all get glazed eyes. Look at the gods and goddesses. Wearing Nikes. And then something happened to me, and this crazy guy, Tim Leary, gave me some mushrooms. And after that, nothing was the same ever again. And that's basically what happened and what you've paid to hear. So before you put it down, realize it's you're biting the hand that's feeding you, so to speak. What happened at that moment was that I saw that I had been a product of an acculturation that was so profound that I was convinced I was who I thought I was. And I awakened to realize that wasn't who I was at all. It was as if I connected with my soul. And up until then, I had been pure, unadulterated ego. Now, it's not that the soul wasn't there, and it's not that the soul's messages weren't available. But my ego had created a reality in which those messages were either irrelevant or didn't even exist because of denial. That for efficiency of functioning on this plane, channels 1 and 2, the ego says, I'll run your ship really tautly. Just don't have any truck with any of that stuff. Those are beings from outer space, and you know how we feel about them. Because when I was born, I didn't have a differentiated framework. I had a disposition to it, a genetic disposition or a karmic disposition. Plenty of space for everything. But basically, my awareness was dealing with undifferentiated phenomena. They're just phenomena. I mean, I had no labels. I didn't know it was a tree or this or that. That's all stuff that I've learned. And Piaget describes beautifully all those stages of learning in early childhood of a cognitive process, of the development of a sense of self and other, and then learning how to manipulate other to get gratification. All that stuff that we do, we all do. But the way I put it in the kind of simple frame that I need for this discussion is, when I was born, I went into somebody training. I went into training to become somebody. My parents both thought I was somebody. Now, their predicament was they thought they were somebody too. And that's why they couldn't free me, or they couldn't teach me my somebodyness in such a way that I wouldn't get trapped in it, because they were trapped in theirs. So they thought I was real as their child, instead of just relatively real. I mean, it's like, okay, let's take birth. Well, what'll you be? Well, I'll be a mother. Okay, I'll be your child. Here we go. Wah!
Whoa.
This is reincarnation. I'm sneaking in on you, so don't accept a word of it, because it's all more illusion. But there are useful illusions. Like the soul is a useful illusion. If you're a Buddhist, you know the soul is going to go sooner or later, because everything goes. Because things are things which go. It's the nature of things. They go. When I awakened and realized I wasn't who I thought I was, and that everything that I did, I could still do, but I was doing it from an entirely different vantage point in my consciousness, It was as if, being a behavioral scientist that treated religion as a kind of a manifestation of the fear of the human mind, a projection of the fear. I mean, I was really super scientist. And then to have an experience which was not something I knew that way. And when I opened to it, it was much more familiar than everything I'd been living in all my life. And I felt, I use words like I've come home. I had come home into a part of my being that I had been cut off from by the effectiveness of the socialization I had undergone. That I had become somebody. And I was really good at it. Because the next training you go into once you're somebody is somebody special training. You must all remember that. Every one of us went into somebody special training. Even if I'm nothing special, that's special. So we all went from into somebody training and then into somebody special training. And then comes the awakening. And you realize that you have been, your computer software has been installed so that you are processing everything that comes in a certain way to define a certain reality. Now, as all of us get more comfortable with virtual reality and all this stuff about computers, that'll be an easy language for us to understand. Virtual reality is a great help in understanding relative reality. It's an experiential analog. That awakening was so discontinuous with my previous consciousness, and yet the power of whatever it was that I had touched, or that I touch, or that I am, was so deep that it was more valid to me than all of the social, cultural, legitimizing structures. You can hear, is this too weird? Are you?
Yeah,
no? Are you here? Are you all here? Some of you can't decide yet. If you don't want to be here, stay here anyway. Just don't be here now. Just try. See how far you can get. Promise me you won't be. I won't be here. It was a great moment when I had been thrown out of Harvard in 1963, and I was the first professor fired from Harvard in the 6,000 years or whatever. So I was really a bad guy. I was on the front page of the New York Times. It was good. It was really. So I found myself at a press conference in which all the reporters and television people were there because to interview. I felt like a fighter who had just lost the big fight and was now going to sweep the gym for the rest of his life. And they were sort of bidding me goodbye, fond adieu for having battled Goliath, you know. And the problem was, as I stood there before the cameras, I thought, I've won. I'm right. And that thought was immediately followed, since I was a psychologist, by the thought, that is psychosis. Even I saw the diagnostic category. When you think something's real, nobody else thinks. Keep an open mind, of course, but uh-huh. And the next thought was, so be it. Because for me to have denied what it was that I had experienced would have left me with a life of total hypocrisy with myself. I mean, it would have left me denying the deepest thing I could feel that was my true being. And what I, of course, wanted to do at that point was to remain in that space. And those of you that have ever used practices like that know that there are highs and there are coming downs. And I would say that I kind of figured if I was clever enough, I could figure out how to get high and stay high. But all my techniques didn't do it. I mean, standing on my head, looking north on Thursdays, you know, standing on one leg, didn't do it. They got me incredibly high. But I began to sense there was something more interesting than getting high. I don't know what words to use that aren't exactly, because words are not it. Something about being free. And being free, the predicament with the high was that it always had the shadow of the low. So you were always, I mean, I have an abhorrence of thinking, of experiencing that my fun and my happiness is based on my denial of those things which would make me sad. Do you hear the predicament? Let's not talk about that today. It's such a pretty day. And I realized at some point that wasn't working. That wasn't working. It wasn't good enough. What had happened to me was that after 6 years of basically using psychedelics, now called entheogens, that pretty soon in California, people with glaucoma can grow. Well, in 1967, well, that was in 61 that I started that whole Meshuggah business. In 67, I went to India because I couldn't figure out what to do to stay high. I mean, when I was in the spirit, I was so compassionate, and I was so present, and I was so loving, and I was so engaged, and it was so beautiful. But when I came down, it was as if shutters would close, or veils would close, and I'd suddenly start to feel myself constrained again in some old familiar person that I knew myself to be, my personality dynamics. Gurdjieff talks about it as the prison cell. And in that metaphor, one would say that a lot of stuff one does to rid oneself of the pain is actually rearranging the furniture in the prison cell. It's not coming out of the prison cell. It's the same image as Plato's cave and the people that are chained and see only the shadows. Somebody gets free and walks to the door and sees the sunlight and the earth and the world, comes back and says, you know, you thought reality was these shadows, but I'll tell you, these are just shadows in your chain, and they, of course they wouldn't believe it. Because it didn't jive with their reality, with their experience of reality. Excuse me. When I went to India, I met Neem Karoli Baba, and that was an interesting experience because what I had met was somebody who had done the trip that I was trying to do. I had met somebody who was what he was. And the words high and low were no longer relevant. I had met a mensch. That's a Sanskrit word for... I had met a real being. That's what you were talking about. And just that did a number of things. It freed me from my attachment to my method, which was basically psychedelic. It didn't make me have an aversion, it just freed me from feeling that that was the only way to do it. Because I was, prior to that, as much an only way-ist as the most Christian fundamentalist is. because it had been the only way for me. And I couldn't imagine any other way working. And now here I met a being who represented what that was. See, I kept reading all these maps from the East, like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, or the Bhagavad Gita, or the Mahabharata, or whatever, the Upanishads, the Vedas, all of that stuff. And I, Persian poetry, mystic poetry, and these were like maps of a terrain of consciousness that Western psychology had nothing to say about. And they were very articulated, very delicate maps of inner states of consciousness. And I recognized them describing inner states that I was saying, these are ineffable, I can't describe them. Because I didn't have the conceptual tools to describe what I was experiencing. And then I read these books and they're giving me this description exquisitely of this inner state of consciousness. So I went to India basically to find map readers. Because I'd try to read the map, but I was reading it from my own Western acculturated mind. Is this predicament too weird, or can you feel what our predicament is? But his presence showed me something. It really showed me that it was possible to be free. And I began to understand that in terms of compassion, the freer you are, the more you are an instrument of compassion. It's the way it works. It's nothing to do with choice. It's not that I'm being compassionate. You are compassion. Or you become, compassion is another way of saying it. Nothing personal. So, and I've got lots of stories about him. There's a great book, Miracle of Love. It's got 1,000 stories about him. At the end of 5 years of working on that book, I had 2,000 stories. I'd culled down to 1,000 essence stories, and I couldn't figure out how to put them together because I couldn't find a human being in there to hang it on. There was no, I could have thrown them up in the air and presented them randomly. Usually you can peg somebody and say, well, that's a mm. Now once I remember a faculty member from Canada who was an old friend came through India and he came to the temple where I was staying with my guru. And my guru had the capacity, it appeared, to my best knowledge over 5 years, to know everything that was going on. So this fellow walked in, I said, let me introduce you to my guru. And I was so proud, I was going to show off my guru. My guru said to him, oh, you come from the United States. And he says, no, I come from Canada. Aha, uh-huh. You have three brothers. No, I'm an only child. And I mean, my guru didn't only just screw the odds up a little. I mean, he just was absolutely out to lunch. And I could see the guy's face, my friend's face, going from, you know, like, show me the light, to, holy, what has Ram Dass been taken in by? Richard, because that's how he knew me as Richard. Then the guy left, saying, nice guru you've got. And I went back to Maharaji, and he told me the guy's whole life story and everything, and he was just laughing at me. And I'm sure it helped the guy, too. So there was one interesting thing he did that I really always retell to myself when I'm back in the green room, sort of getting ready to come out. Because usually there's somebody sitting in the green room, like me. If there were nobody in the green room, you'd get a better lecture, but there is somebody. So the question is to get rid of that somebody before I get here. I understand, that's a, professional discussion. So in this story, I'm in Allahabad. This is in 1971, and there are maybe 30 people in the room. It's called darshan, for those of you that might not be familiar with these terms. It's where a spiritual teacher just hangs out, and people have a chance to sit around quietly or ask questions or just look or just listen or just be there. And it happens once a day or twice a day when that particular spiritual being is in town. So I was there minding my own business, and sitting back a few rows was a very distinguished looking Indian gentleman. And my guru was making a great deal of this man, treating him with great respect. Finally, my guru started to say, well, you know who we have here, and then he proceeded to talk about me as a great professor. I mean, it was like thick. I mean, thick. I thought, what is he doing? I mean, what an absurd thing to do. So the man said, well, how very interesting. Perhaps Ram Dass would like to visit the courts, because it turned out he was the head of the Supreme Court of that state. Now, I grew up in a family of lawyers, and I didn't go to India to visit the courts, I'll tell you. However, what I said to this man, I turned around and I said to him, well, that would be very nice. That's the thing you say, you know, when somebody asks you for something you don't want to do, that would be very nice. So he said, tomorrow? Now I realized I was getting trapped. So I said, think very cleverly, well, you'll have to ask my guru. So the man turns to my guru and he asks, and my guru says, oh, if Ram Dass said that'll be lovely, that'll be lovely. And he looked at me like, you know, don't screw around, baby. So off I went to the Supreme Court, and, you know, I watched murder trials, and it was lovely. And, so then I was taken into the the room where the lawyers hang out in their black robes and wigs, and it's great fun. I mean, it's like a spy print of some sort. And they surrounded me, because I was a Westerner from the States, and they started to ask me about Nixon's China policy. That was right at that moment, you know, remember, when Nixon was cozying up to China, which is a great threat to India, because they share a common border. So I had read Time magazine, so I was extremely erudite, and, you know, I had positions about everything. And they were impressed. So then I went back to my guru to have the next round of darshan. And he said, what happened to the court? He was all excited. I'd start to tell him something, and then he'd finish my sentences. Like, and then you saw it had three judges. You know, like, okay. It's like you feel like a Charlie McCarthy doll. So that evening at the darshan, there was a man there with, I remember, very long ears. And he was very distinguished looking. And we struck up a conversation. He said, I've been hoping to meet you. He said, we were all so impressed with what you said in the lawyer's suites. I wonder if you would like to speak to the Bar Association. And I'm also head of the Rotary Club of Allahabad. And would you like to speak to the Rotary Club? So I thought, well, it's like going on the vegetarian cream chicken circuit, you know. So I said, you'll have to ask my guru. Since I wasn't going to get caught twice. So Maharaji said, oh, come everybody, listen, Ram Dass has been invited to speak to the Rotary Club. And I thought, that turncoat. I mean, here I'm doing it straight and he's doing this to me. I'm going to get another guru. So then he said to me, after he told everybody how wonderful it was, I was getting this great honor. He turned to me, he says, what are you going to talk about? So it had just dawned on me that I was going to talk, let alone not knowing what I was talking about. So I desperately thought, I thought the Dharma is the law of spirit, the Dharma and the law. You know, that'll be nice. Acha, good, good. And the lawyer was nodding. Maharaji said, are you going to speak about Hanuman? Now, Hanuman is the monkey god who I'm named after, who is a one of the pantheon in Hinduism that is the form of devotion to God through service. It's a form of one of the nine forms of coming to God, like Mary comes with Jesus as mother to child, or John and Jesus as friend, and so on. This is a servant. So I said, oh, of course I'm going to talk about Hanuman. Maharaji said, are you going to talk about Christ? Of course, Maharaji. Why wouldn't I talk about Christ? Maharaji said, are you going to talk about me? I said, well, you're my guru. How could I not talk about you? So the lawyer is getting more and more concerned. And he said, no, he said, we thought Ram Dass would talk about Nixon's China policy. Maharaji looked aghast. He said, you could never trust him with anything that important. He said, he can only talk about God. I said, yes, that's right. I only speak about God. And the lawyer hemmed and hawed, and he said, you know, it might be better if I get a small group of people to my home for you to come and speak to instead of all those big meetings. And I said, fine, and I never heard from him again. So when I'm sitting in the back, you know, I run through this story and I hear him saying, oh, Ram Dass speaks only about God. And what I've been learning how to do is figuring out all the ways to speak about God. Because I've been doing it now for 23 years. And it's interesting, do you realize, since what we're talking about is unspeakable and unknowable by our analytic mind, all the words and all the metaphors are just metaphors. They're things where you're pointing at something, but the pointing, the finger, isn't the same as the thing itself. So when I ask myself, what does it mean to speak about God? Because though I grew up as a Jew in Boston, the Old Testament model is not harmonious with my being. It's much too contracted, constricted. And I begin to see that religions at the leading edge, at where they come from, are created, when you go back into the source, you find the mystics. You find the people that went into the mystery and then come back and then find a way to say what it was that happened to them. And what you're left with is what they said, which is not what happened to them. You hear the distinction? And then, because I, like Tim Leary and I did a book back in, with Ralph Metzner, back in the, somewhere in the 60s. The psychedelic experience was based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Now there was a manual 2,500 years old for reading to a monk by fellow monks during the 49 days after they die. Starts at the time of death, and you read to them for 49 days. And you read to them about the bardos, or the islands, or the places they are meeting in those 49 days. And you say, now you may meet beings that are very wrathful and they may frighten you. But just remember, this is all more dream stuff, and just keep looking at it and allowing it and then go on. It's to try to guide you so you don't get trapped in all these places that in the Tibetan experience of near-death experiences or meditation or whatever, they have arrived at this structure. But if I look at the Judeo-Christian structure, it's different. If I look at the Islamic structure, it's different. The Taoist structure is different. And what I see is that these are all the conceptual mind attempting to describe the mystery. And what I've arrived at is a sense that my life is surrounded, immersed in a mystery. And the ways you come close to the edge you'll find in your life of playing with the edge of that mystery is around suffering. Like, why should little children die of starvation when there's enough food in the world? Around suffering, around death, around birth. Because when I go to a birth or I go to a death, it's roughly the same experience for me. It's where the form and the formless, it's right at the edge of the lake of the formless.
Please flip the tape now and begin side B.